This week, the UN warns of looming mass starvation in Gaza as aid groups are unable to get in because of shortages of fuel and a communications shutdown.
People are surviving on just one meal a day, if they are lucky.
They want their family members back. Thousands march in Israel pleading for the government to do more for the release of loved ones held hostage by Hamas.
Seven of my family members are kidnapped in Gaza. My mother, my sister's husband, and their children, who are 8 and 3 years old. A 3-year-old girl is in Gaza.
And a global crisis that transcends borders, as new reports warn humanity's fight to curb climate change is failing in dozens of ways. Join us on Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. UN officials say a lack of fuel to power phone networks and vehicles is complicating efforts to deliver humanitarian aid in Gaza. The warning comes a day after the World Food Program warned the situation in Gaza has grown dire and said civilians face the immediate possibility of starvation due to the lack of food supplies. WFP Palestine Country Director Samer Abdeljaber.
In Gaza, people are surviving on just one meal a day, if they are lucky. Fuel shortages and loss of connectivity are crippling our operation in Gaza. The lack of fuel has forced the last WFP contracted bakery to shut down and the last mill to stop grinding wheat flour. Even bread, the cornerstone of every Palestinian diet, has now become a rarity.
The communications blackout, now in its second day, largely cuts off Gaza's 2.3 million people from one another and the outside world and paralyzes the coordination of aid. The lack of power and medical supplies has crippled hospitals in Gaza, and the Shifa Hospital has become a focal point of Israel's military operation. Dr. Omar Abdel Manan.
Al-Shifa is a war zone. This is not a hospital anymore. It used to be a hospital. It used to be one of the best hospitals in Gaza, the largest trauma center with some of the best surgeons in the world.
Israel faces growing international pressure to prove the claim that Hamas set up its main command center in and under the hospital. This, as Palestinian medics say, they're increasingly afraid for the lives of hundreds of patients and medical staff at Gaza's biggest hospital, which has been cut off from all links to the outside world since Israeli forces entered. Lucy Fielder with Reuters has more.
Video shot earlier this week is the last the world has seen of some of the medical staff caring for hundreds of patients still trapped inside Gaza's Ashifa hospital. Reuters journalists have been unable to reach anyone there for more than 24 hours. They were effectively cut off from the outside world as of Wednesday, after Israeli forces moved inside the facility.
There, this is the bag that we found.
Israel's military later released this video of rifles and flak jackets it said its soldiers found there. But it has so far produced no evidence of the vast Hamas headquarters that both it and Washington said was operating beneath Gaza's biggest hospital. The White House stood by its intelligence assessment about Ashifa on Thursday.
Grab and go.
Meanwhile, global alarm among humanitarian groups is growing. Ashifa is also hosting thousands of people displaced by weeks of Israeli airstrikes and artillery bombardments. The World Health Organization said it was trying to arrange a medical evacuation of about 600 patients inside Ashifa, including 27 in critical condition and 36 newborn babies removed from incubators for want of power because Israel has cut off fuel supplies.
The situation, the humanitarian and health situation in Gaza really is catastrophic.
Regional Emergencies Director Rick Brennan said there were many challenges, including negotiating safety guarantees with Israel's military and a lack of the fuel needed for ambulances just to bring out patients.
But there are a lot of security concerns. There are a lot of logistics constraints. Our options are rather limited. But we hope to have some better news in the next 24 hours.
Israeli forces have effectively shut down all hospitals in the northern part of the enclave and ordered the area's evacuation. Human Rights Watch warned hospitals have special protections under international humanitarian law. Israel has now dropped leaflets in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, ordering civilians to leave four towns on the edge of Khan Yunis. Atiya Abu Jabal was among tens of thousands of displaced people in the area, now wondering where they're supposed to go next. Other residents said the area came under heavy bombardment overnight.
Lucy Fielder with Reuters reporting. Meanwhile, children are paying the highest price for the war in Gaza. I spoke with Steve Sossaby, president and founder of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, about what his staff in Gaza is reporting.
So obviously on this situation in Gaza, there's been a complete breakdown of the health system, particularly related to treatment of children. In addition to that, the challenges that kids on the ground in Gaza are facing are compounded by the fact that the vast majority of those children are now displaced persons. They're living in schools, UN schools, or living in substandard housing with, 40, 50 people in one or two rooms. They're sharing toilets with 300, 400, 500 people. They're living in tents. There's food insecurity. They're living on reduced calories because of the lack of access to food and also the lack of clean water, the inability to take showers. They don't have warm clothing. Many of them fled their homes when the weather was a little bit warmer, and now that was a month ago. Now the winter is coming on to Gaza, and that's going to impact their well-being. And the fact is that aid organizations like ours are not able to get them the basic necessities that they need, whether it's food, water, clothing, medication, and so on. And as a result of the borders being closed or at least significantly reduced, in that trucks are not coming in enough to bring in even the small percentage of what's actually needed by the general population there. They need the basics. They need food and water, but they also need clothing. They need medication. They need shelter. They need hygiene kits. They need access to medication and medical care, and that's also a significant factor as well. And that's not even talking about the number of injured and killed children in Gaza. We know that now, between those who are missing and presumed buried under rubble and those who've actually been documented as fatalities in Gaza, that 6,000 children have been killed out of a population of 1 million. In addition, we have another 10,000 children with significant injuries, including amputations and spinal cord injuries and significant injuries that will require extended periods of reconstructive surgery and rehabilitation, which those services are not available in Gaza as well. The entire infrastructure of hospitals is broken down. The accessibility of treatment for patients is broken down. Not only the children who have been injured and suffer these terrible injuries do not have access to care anymore because of the lack of fuel in the hospitals, but also hospitals like the Rantisi Pediatric Hospital and the Nasser Pediatric Hospital, both have been shut down and do not have any patients in them at all. We know that neonatal units, which are housing premature babies, are not providing care any longer due to the lack of fuel and electricity to run the incubators. Patients in the intensive care units, particularly children, are not having artificial breathing ventilators to keep them alive as a result of the lack of fuel. And this is obviously having a tremendous detrimental effect on the health situation there. If you add to it as well that kids who have other types of medical conditions that require access to medical treatment, like, for example, kids with diabetes, kids with on dialysis, kids with cancer, kids with heart conditions, kids with cystic fibrosis, kids that have medical needs that require access to treatment are not getting that treatment as well. So it's a complete breakdown of the health system related to the welfare of children.
And so you have offices in Gaza. Are your staff able to do anything at this point, given the situation?
Our staff are documenting cases who we can get out for medical care. So we have children who are injured, who have suffered significant injuries or have other kind of medical conditions. Our organizations over the years was the main organization on the ground, bringing in volunteer medical teams to provide surgery and surgical treatment for children. Those teams are not coming in. So we have these kids to send outside for care that they otherwise can't get. So that's what our doctors are doing.
Are they able to get them out?
Well, that's the challenge, is getting them access to getting their names on the list across the border at Rafah. And we've just started the process of identifying these kids because obviously in the situation on the ground, our staff are not working currently in the field simply because it's too dangerous and there's nothing for them to do. There's no vehicles for them to take. Cars don't have gas. People are not, there isn't any aid to provide because we're not able to get it into Gaza. All of the aid that we have to bring in now has to be brought in from outside. We cannot purchase it from the local market. The local markets are exhausted.
And you mentioned the kids having shelter in schools with hundreds of others.
In some cases, thousands.
How are they staying safe? It doesn't seem like there is really anywhere to be certain that people are safe, especially children.
And that's the problem, is that there are no places for kids to be safe. And that continues to be a challenge, is that for our staff and for everyone there, is although they've claimed that if you go south, you're going to a safe area. The fact is that 40% of the casualties are taking place in the south. So there are no safe spaces.
What about their mental health? This has to be traumatizing and terrifying on these children.
Mental health is probably the biggest factor that is not seen, because these are emotional scars that these kids are bearing, not physical ones. funds. And the fact is that every single child in the Gaza Strip, and we're talking about 1 million children out of a population of 2.2 million, are suffering from and will suffer from long-term trauma and emotional trauma, for the lack of a better word. They're going to suffer from mental health challenges as a result of being exposed to continuous violence and insecurity and fear and death and destruction and injuries. And this has been going on for an extended period of time, even prior to October 7th. So there's a whole generation of children, and it's affecting the entire Gaza Strip. Every single person, adults and children, are walking away with traumatic stress disorder. And I'm going to call it current traumatic stress disorder. It's usually called post, but in the case of Gaza, there's nothing post about it. It's just going on and on and on. And therefore, the long-term implications, and short-term for that matter, are quite concerning, because you cannot build a civil society. You cannot have, let's just say, a normal society in which the entire population has been traumatized through violence, especially children. And that's what we have in Gaza today. It affects their education. It affects their social relationships. It affects their development, their emotional development. It affects their ability to function in society, to concentrate, to develop. And this is quite of a challenge, because to adequately treat these children, you need to have some kind of environment which is healing and gives them space to recover. And we don't have that in Gaza, and there's no indication that's going to happen anytime soon.
Steve Sossaby, president and founder of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Friday marked 42 days since about 240 Israelis and foreign nationals were kidnapped during the October 7th Hamas onslaught on Israeli communities, a march calling for the release of all hostages held by Palestinian militants in Gaza proceeded Friday toward Jerusalem, with thousands of relatives, friends, and supporters of the cause participating.
Seven of my family members are kidnapped in Gaza. My mother, my sister's husband, and their children, who are 8 and 3 years old. A 3 year old girl is in Gaza. My aunt and cousin who is 12. How can you put a price on a 3 year old girl? We need them back now at any price.
Meanwhile, the funeral of 19 year old Israeli soldier Noah Martiano, who was kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th, was held Friday after Israeli forces in Gaza recovered her remains near Shifa Hospital. The body of another hostage, Yehudit Weiss, was found Thursday as Israeli troops searched the hospital complex, and friends and family gathered to remember Canadian-Israeli peace activist Vivian Silver on Thursday, 2 days after they learned that she had been killed in the massacre and not taken captive by Hamas, as been presumed. John Linden, executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, who knew her well, spoke with me about the loss of someone beloved by Israelis and Palestinians.
So, John, the last time we spoke, we were talking about how you'd been in touch with Vivian Silver's son, and there was the thought that because her cell phone was found in Gaza, that she was one of the hostages, and they were holding on to hope. And unfortunately, the news changed this week. She was an important part of the efforts for peace in the Middle East, not just for Israel, not just for the Palestinians, but for coexistence. I understand you've known her for a long time. What can you tell us about who she was?
Yeah, I mean, Vivian was one of the most extraordinary figures in the peace-building movement, and for a very, very long time. So she moved to Israel in the 70s from Canada after a brief stop over in New York, and she kind of set about building things almost immediately. She introduced, first of all, feminism and women's rights as a core principle into the kibbutz movement, and then she set her sights on women's rights more generally inside Israel, and then Arab-Jewish equality. She co-founded an organization that's a member of ALMEPS called Ajik Nisbid, which focuses on relations between Bedouin Arabs in the south of Israel and Jews, and building sort of Arab-Jewish partnership with one of the most underprivileged and historically neglected populations in Israel. And she really turned Ajik into a powerhouse. It is now today the leading organization of its kind, really transforming the lives of tens of thousands of people in the south of Israel over recent decades. And she retired from Ajik in 2014, and that's also when the devastating Gaza-Israel war happened that summer. she lived in Kibbutz Be'eri, which is right on the Gaza border, and reacted. This tells you a lot about Vivian. She reacted to that war, not with despair or anger, but with determination to change this reality. And as a recent retiree, co-founded Women Wage Peace, which has now grown to a movement of over 40,000 people, women working for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. She's extraordinary also for us at OLMEP. She would be passing through Washington, D.C. and doing meetings at Congress, and she met our founder, Avi Meierstein, almost 20 years ago, and he said, we're going to found this network of peace-building NGOs, and she said, I'm in, and really helped him and us as we grew to think through the structure, the strategy, everything about it, and was a constant mentor and ally in this. I mean, when I was made executive director 5 years ago, I visited her in Kibbutz Be'eri, and she took me aside and gave me the most powerful 20-minute presentation on this forensic analysis of what was required in Israel-Palestine. It was extraordinary. And then almost at the drop of a hat, she switched back into Vivian the grandmother mode as other people arrived, and was suddenly kind of avuncular and funny and playful. And she was the smartest woman, smartest person in every room she ever walked into, but she kind of carried it really lightly. She was one of a kind.
And apparently, as you said, really integral in the peace movement and in your organization's development as well. So what a great loss to the world. And obviously it was something she was extremely passionate about.
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of passionate people in our space, and we have a lot of sort of smart, strategic people, and we have these kind of determined sort of never give up people. We don't have all that many people who have all those qualities combined. Although the one thing I'd say, and it's very moving, both when we thought she had been taken hostage, but now in particular, since very late on Monday night when we found out she'd been murdered, the number of people who have reacted, both Palestinians and Israelis, with this sort of determination to carry forward Vivian's sort of ethos and way of being, like seeing this as being almost a torch being passed on. It's really moving. I wish she was here to see it, but obviously that's impossible. But the number of people whose lives she touched and that she really provided guidance to, and I was even going through my own WhatsApp messages with her, she just offered advice, and not in a kind of, you know, superior way or anything. It was just like really smart, shrewd advice and instruction and solidarity when things are bad. And I know for a fact there's hundreds of people that have similar WhatsApp threads with her, and they're probably looking through them this week too. So but your legacy lives on. I suppose going to be a memorial Thursday in Israel for her, and I think you're going to see Palestinians and Israelis, Jews and Arabs coming together at probably the greatest scale we've seen since October 7th, and that's Vivian's legacy too.
This was a complete shock to you and all those who loved her and her family as well. Obviously
the legacy she leaves behind are organizations and lives she touched, but all of us, our children, right, are the most obvious one. I've had the chance to spend a bit of time now with her son Jonathan, and we arranged a meeting on Saturday when we still thought she was held hostage with him and another leader from our space, Mohammed Darasha, and the German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, who was in Tel Aviv. And he was channeling Vivian. Like, and he's a social worker working on other issues in Tel Aviv. He'd actually been a bit disenchanted from the peace movement, he would say so himself, and in recent years. And he's just the strength of pivoting straight to what needs to happen around peace, around the only way security is going to come for Israelis is through peace with Palestinians. And that's when he thought she was kidnapped. And then yesterday, literally like 12 hours after finding out she'd been murdered, it was the same message. It was, you know, directly saying we have to find a way to live together. We need to redouble efforts towards peace. And it's extraordinary. The apple didn't fall very far from the tree. And I think he has been an example to all of us. If we're feeling like we're in the dumps and depressed, if he, her son, is able to react in this sort of far-sighted and wise way, then we have to do it too.
John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. The past 12 months were the hottest the Earth has ever recorded, according to a new report by nonprofit science research group Climate Central.
The rooftops of the world are caving in. This tragedy is unfolding in two perilous chapters. Phase one is the story of melting glaciers and ice sheets. Record temperatures mean record glacier melt.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, ahead of the COP28 climate conference later this month in Dubai, appealed for urgent action to reduce emissions.
Melting glaciers mean swollen lakes and rivers flooding, sweeping away entire communities, and seas rising at record rates, threatening coastal communities across the globe. The crisis is gaining speed.
Humanity's fight to curb climate change is failing in dozens of ways, with people getting sicker and dying as the world warms. That, according to two global reports issued this week. Part of the findings came from the medical journal Lancet's Countdown on Health and Climate Change. I spoke with Lancet Countdown Executive Director Marina Romanello for details on the report's findings.
This is the eighth annual iteration of the Lancet Countdown reports. The Lancet Countdown reports bring together 114 researchers from across many different disciplines. And we try to do this holistic assessment of the links between climate change and health. And year on year, we're seeing that the health impacts of climate change are worsening rapidly. In this year, we're seeing that just at 1.14 degrees, the impacts of climate change are costing lives and livelihoods all around the world. And for the first time this year, we're doing projections that show us that we're moving in a very difficult and very dangerous path. And what's worse is that since last year, we've seen that we have not only not taken enough action, but we have actually moved in the wrong direction.
When you talk about we're losing lives and livelihoods, we're talking about people literally losing their lives because of heat waves in recent years, soaring temperatures. How much did that increase specifically for the elderly?
Look, we're seeing through our model, through our analysis, that since the 90s, heat-related mortality in adults over 65 years of age that are particularly vulnerable to extreme heat exposure have increased by 85%. And for the first time this year, we're pinning down the influence of the rising temperatures. And now we know that that is more than twice the level expected if temperatures hadn't changed. So we know that climate change is behind this. And to give you another idea, every individual in the world on average was exposed in 2022 to 86 days of health-threatening temperatures, high temperatures. 60% of those were more than twice as likely to occur because of climate change. So we're now beginning to understand that many of the impacts that we're seeing can be attributed to the influence that we're having on our environment. And that is the loss of life, the loss of good health. But we're also seeing, as you mentioned, loss of livelihoods. We know that exposure to extreme heat impairs people's capacity to work, particularly for workers that work outdoors, like agricultural workers, construction workers, particularly vulnerable workers. And the potential labor hours that were lost because of the high temperatures increased by 42% since the 90s. And in 2022, our estimates are that because of the loss in income, the global economy has lost more than $860 billion.
And there's the issue of hunger, which goes along with drought and heat and water issues. Did your report talk about that?
Yeah, look, we're seeing particularly concerning trends in everything that has to do with food security. We see that climate change, as I was saying, impacts agricultural workers that will reduce the productivity from the agricultural sector that our food depends on. The impacts on income will also make food more unaffordable, impair our access to food. And extreme weather events are also affecting our food productivity, our affecting our supply chains. And all of these impacts now compound to make a situation that is particularly dangerous today. And what we're estimating is that the experience of food insecurity, that is people that could not access the food that they needed to meet their nutritional needs, was increased by 127 million more people in 2021 as a result of an increased incidence of heat waves and of droughts. So directly related to our changing climate. That is 127 million more people that couldn't access the food that they needed because of the climate changing.
With this happening now and the situation projected to worsen, we are facing an unfathomable future. If this is how it is now already, and it's expected to worsen and if things don't change.
Absolutely. So we're currently at 1.14 degrees of global mean temperature rise above pre-industrial times. That is sounds like something very little, 1.14 degrees Celsius. But if we look at the impacts that we're seeing today, we see just how significant that is. And to give you an idea, our current policies and actions are driving us to a world that will heat by 3 degrees Celsius, almost 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. If these are the impacts at 1.14, we can only imagine what that future would look like. But this year, for the first time, we've done some analysis of what even staying at 2 degrees of heating would look like. That is one of the targets of the Paris Agreement. And what we're seeing is that at 2 degrees, already by mid-century, food insecurity is expected to rise, reaching 500 million more people suffering food insecurity. We expect heat-related mortality to increase by almost 400%. We expect our increase in labor hours lost to be 50% 50% more than it is today, and the expansion of infectious diseases, every single aspect that we're monitoring will exacerbate enormously in a world that keeps global mean temperature rise to 2 degrees. And we're even worse than that. So that is why we're saying we urgently need climate action for a healthy future. But as I said, we're moving in the wrong direction.
Marina Romanello, Executive Director of the Lancet Countdown. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until next time, I'm Lori London.